at the center, a cock, a pig, and a snake. At the center of the wheel are three animals portrayed as symbols of mental poisons. A cock stands for craving, a pig for delusion, and a snake for the venom of our hatred. They all bite each other's tails because these mental poisons do not exist without each other. They are all aspects of the same problem. They all give rise to each other continuously. The poisons are ways we withdraw from awareness of the real into a constricted, subjective, and therefore false world of our own projections. They constitute the main motor of the wheel.
Unskillful mental states are preceded by mind, led by mind, and made up of mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows him, even as the cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox.
The rise and fall, karma and rebirth. The next circle out consists of cheerful individuals moving up a sort of escalator on one side, and unhappy figures apparently falling downstairs on the other, as if the escalator had stopped suddenly. In a sense, this is what has happened. The figures moving up are self-possessed, maintaining their awareness. But almost inevitably, there is a moment of inattention. One's flow of mindfulness comes to a halt, and one trips up and falls headlong. On the small scale, this picture represents the flow of our volitions, our moods and habits of mind from moment to moment, and their observable results. We are either acting creatively, we are either alive to ourselves and others, or else we react. We allow our unconscious emotional reactions to dictate our actions. On the large scale, it represents individuals reaping the results of their actions from one lifetime to the next. This is the law of conditionality as applied to volitional or deliberately willed action or karma. Some people live charmed lives, while others attract trouble and suffering to themselves. So why is this? To begin with, one just needs to observe that the world one finds oneself in tends to mirror one's mental states. For example, when one is in a good mood, one doesn't even notice all the horrible things that usually upset one. It is as if one were in a different world. This tendency accounts for some of our experience. Much of the rest is accounted for in Buddhism by recognizing an extension of this tendency into an endless series of lives. The result of behaving in a way that reinforces our ignorance, craving, and hatred is that we help to create a world driven by those forces. The result of behaving in a way that reflects a state of mind dominated by joy, generosity, kindness, and insight, on the other hand, is that we find ourselves entering a world in which these values are generally subscribed to and supported. This, essentially, is the way the law of karma in Buddhism works. In rejecting the commonly accepted notion of a soul, the Buddha was also transforming the commonly accepted idea of rebirth. If what is reborn is not ultimately a self, then what exactly is reborn? All we can say is that there is something, whether we describe it as a flow of impulses, currents, or energies, or as a general temperament, or collection of propensities, habits, humors, or qualities, which continues into a suitable rebirth after the death of the body. This view of the workings of karma explains a lot of otherwise inexplicable character traits and abilities to be found in children, without suggesting anything like the idea of reincarnation or transmigration of souls. All we need say is that there is a significant connection between a particular person who dies and a particular person who is born. A further refinement of the idea of karma to be found in Buddhism is the recognition that not everything that happens to us is the result of our karma. The ethical dimension is only one aspect of the way the law of conditionality works in the world we have chosen through our karma to inhabit. Suppose there is a man suffering from fever. The complaint may be due to a sudden change in temperature, to the presence of a germ, to mental strain or worry, or to tension due to experiences taking place in meditation, to the fact that in a previous life he had harmed someone, or to chemical and cellular changes occurring in the body consequent upon transcendental realization. What this means is that one cannot make other people karmically responsible for their own misfortunes. Things happen for all sorts of reasons, not just karma. However, we can say that our karma has brought us into a world where these sorts of things may happen. So one still has to take an overall responsibility for one's situation. Moreover, karma in Buddhism works according to the law, not of causation, but of conditionality. Thus, something done by one person will not have the same result as the same action performed by someone else, because in each case, the action will be part of a unique web of conditions. The Buddha also defined karma as being firmly and precisely based on an ethics of intent, rather than an ethics of social control. This was an apparently simple but revolutionary step. The greatest evils are usually performed by people who are trying to do the right thing, instead of being aware of what they are doing. For example, burning witches. But for a Buddhist, a good action is simply one that reflects some kind of awareness of the true nature of reality, that reflects an intuitive sense of solidarity with all that lives. A bad action is one that doesn't. It's not one that necessarily breaks any rules. It just tightens and hardens one's sense of self and reinforces a mistaken view of things. Someone who chooses to act unethically is like someone who decides to wear shoes that are 1.5 sizes too small. It's just not very clever. One may hardly notice the discomfort to begin with, because after all, one is looking good in those shoes. But at some point, one starts to suffer. And it is as if, instead of taking responsibility for choosing those shoes, one were to blame the shoes themselves. So karma and rebirth provides an ethical pattern to life, without resorting to the idea of justice and punishment.
Do not underestimate evil, thinking just once will make no difference. A water pot left under a dripping spout will become full. Likewise, the spiritually immature little by little fills himself with evil. Do not underestimate good, thinking just once will make no difference. A water pot left under a dripping spout will become full. Likewise, the wise man, little by little, fills himself with good. Not in the sky, nor in the midst of the sea, nor yet in the clefts of the mountains, nowhere in the world is there any place to be found where one can abide free from one's evil deeds. Not in the sky, nor in the midst of the sea, nor yet in the clefts of the mountains. Nowhere in the world is there any place to be found where one will not be overcome by death.
The six realms of existence. The next circle of the wheel of life is a series of six representative worlds, or realms, or dimensions of existence. The heaven realm, the realm of the jealous gods, the animal realm, the hell realm, the realm of the hungry ghosts, and the human realm. If one gets used to the supersensory and blissful experience of meditative concentration, then one will be naturally drawn to a rebirth in a heaven realm, which is pictured in a segment at the top of the wheel. This is where the figures moving up the escalator end up. The heavens, however, are not eternal, and nor are the gods, even though it might seem that way, as they do live a very long time indeed. Eventually, the gods do start to slip down the stairs. Even the divine life is conditioned, and thus impermanent. By following certain meditative procedures, one may be reborn in a heavenly existence. But if one has not also gained insight or wisdom, then that state of mind is reversible. The roots of ignorance, and thus craving, and the hatred that comes with thwarted craving will not have been touched. On the other hand, if one has a mind that is almost exclusively one of hatred and paranoia, or intense craving, then one is going to feel most at home in a hell realm, two of which are portrayed at the bottom of the wheel. Without anyone passing judgment or condemning, that is where one finds oneself. Someone who managed the unlikely feat of living a purely animal existence would be reborn in the animal realm. And those who are so intensely competitive and hungry for power that the opportunities in the human realm are not enough for them will be born in the realm of the Titans, the jealous gods. So are these realms supposed to be real? They are as real, we may say, as the mental states of which they are the objective counterparts. The Buddha certainly recognized them as separate dimensions of existence into which individuals might be born. But he was said to have the advantage of seeing them directly. They are certainly not absolutely real. There is no eternal damnation. The wheel is always turning. It is up to us to decide how fast or slow we see it turning. Also, they can reflect the lives we make for ourselves here and now. If we look around, we can see that some people do live lives with the character of the heaven realm, the hell realm, or they live like animals. The wheel of life is ostensibly an account of the workings of the cosmos, but if we turn it a bit faster, we see a description of the different conditions of existence in our own world. And when we spin it even faster, we get a mirror of the day-to-day workings of one's own mind, in which we can go from heaven to hell, or from the animal to the healthy human realm within the space of a few minutes. In the end, the process is the same. Just as there are social circles in which people know how to enjoy the finer things in life and have the effortless means to do so, likewise one has one's own heaven realms in one's own life, happy and pleasurable times or circumstances that one takes for granted and assumes are there forever. Whether one inhabits a heavenly dimension as a god, or whether one is born with a silver spoon in one's mouth, or whether one is simply feeling happy, in such circumstances one has to practice mindfulness to consciously maintain clarity. If we are enjoying life, it may seem to be life-denying to bring sober reality into the situation. But the opposite is the case.
Mindfulness is the way to the immortal. Unmindfulness, the way to death. Those who are mindful do not die, but the unmindful are like the dead.
It is to bring this message to the gods that in the wheel of life a Buddha appears in this realm, playing on a lute the song of impermanence. In the animal realm there is a Buddha holding a book, indicating that sometimes practicing the Dharma involves no more than taking our noses out of the trough. In one hell realm, a Buddha dispenses ointment. The Buddha in the other brings nectar. Here, the Dharma is a process of healing rather than punishing, and nourishing rather than feeding addictions. Amongst the Titans, there is a Buddha wielding a sword, but it is the sword of wisdom to shatter the spell of wealth and power that drives such beings. Finally, in the human realm, there stands a Buddha with a begging bowl. So, whatever one's situation in life, however difficult one's circumstances, the way is open. The Dharma is available in some form. The outer rim of the wheel. The most crucial aspect of the wheel of life is that it is a wheel, a circle. Thus, it doesn't have a beginning or end. In this, it subverts the view we have of life. It tells us that we aren't actually going anywhere, unless we make the decision to move off the wheel of life altogether. To do this, we need to understand the overall mechanism, and this is analyzed in the outer rim of the wheel of life, which consists of 12 segments, in each of which is a picture representing a significant link in a continuous circular series. For example, the blind man represents ignorance, the monkey, consciousness. In dependence upon ignorance arises consciousness. There is no entry point to the circle. It has no beginning. But the crucial link holding the circle together is ignorance or delusion, from which arises the next one, the volitions, that bring about rebirth, and thus the development of senses from which feeling arises, and thus craving, and then attachment, which in turn leads to a fresh rebirth. Even from this simplified, rough outline, the significance of the series should become clear. The whole process of factors, each arising out of a previous factor, is taking place at every moment. Every moment we give birth to ourselves, as the mind, in its ignorance of itself, closes round an object. However, there is one point in the circle where there is a crack of light, and this is the third of the Four Noble Truths. The third noble truth: the cessation of suffering, the end of craving.
The mindful who go forth do not delight in hearth and home. Like wild geese quitting a lake, they abandon their security. Like the earth, the man of principle offers no opposition. Like the main pillar of the city gate, he stands firm. He is pure, like a lake free from mud. For a man of such qualities, there are no more wanderings from life to life.
The glimmer of illumination occurs between feeling and craving. This is where the middle way must be driven, between self-mortification, the suppression of feelings, and self-indulgence, going beyond feeling to craving. This is where our moments of awareness arise. The practice of mindfulness, of steady watchfulness, is designed to open up that gap of awareness. This is particularly the case in meditation, where the whole wheel can be slowed down a bit, thus enabling us to observe some of its workings for ourselves. The third noble truth is that of the cessation of suffering, or nirvana. Applying the principle of dependent origination, we may say that if suffering arises in dependence on craving, then it will cease on the cessation of craving.
Whatever is of the nature of arising, all that is of the nature of cessation.
What this means is that we do not need something outside the world to end our suffering. The traditional religious view is that liberation involves leaving the world behind. The audacious realization of the Buddha was that all one had to leave behind was one's delusion. The mechanics of suffering are such that they can be made to go into reverse, and for this, no God is required. Nirvana means blowing out, or extinction, meaning an extinction of craving, hatred, and delusion in a realization of how they arise. There is little more to say about it than this, because it involves a kind of spiraling off the whole frame of reference within which we experience life and think about it. It is a knowledge which is non-conceptual. It does not involve an extinction of the self, because there was never a self in the first place. What does not in reality exist cannot be said to cease to exist. But there is an end of rebirth. There is no more going round and round the wheel of samsara, because the basic motor of the mental poisons has stopped in the full realization that no one in reality is reborn. The craving to experience something other than what one is experiencing, to escape from what is here and now, to evade the karmic consequences of one's actions, has come to an end. One is no longer bound to the wheel of time, the going on and on of things that is samsara. Time stops. So nirvana is also described as the deathless or the unconditioned. But nirvana is not a kind of absolute reality apart from the relative reality of samsara. Nirvana consists simply in seeing samsara as it really is, and thus becoming free of it. In fact, with the end of the self-protecting sense of separation from the world, there is no more holding on to distinctions, and thus no distinction experienced at all between samsara and nirvana.
There is, monks, the stage where there is neither earth, nor water, nor fire, nor wind, nor the stage of the infinity of space, nor the stage of the infinity of consciousness, nor the stage of neither consciousness nor non-consciousness, neither this world or the other world, nor sun and moon. There, monks, I say, there is neither coming, nor going, nor staying, nor passing away, nor arising. Without support, or going on, or basis, is it? This indeed is the end of pain. There is, monks, an unborn, an unbecome, an unmade, an uncompounded. If, monks, there were not here this unborn, unbecome, unmade, uncompounded, there would not here be an escape from the born, the become, the made, the compounded.
So how does one approach this? Through not indulging one's craving, one can start to become a bit more aware of oneself and of others, of the world and of the nature of things. There is discomfort in this middle way of resisting the urge to escape from this awareness, either into sense enjoyments or into repressing one's feelings. But this is replaced, particularly in meditation, by a more subtle pleasure, arising from the drawing together of scattered energies and the expansive opening out to the feelings of others, and a deep joy arising from a sense of faith in what one is doing. Enlightenment, or nirvana, is basically an infinite extension of this process. For nirvana is not a state, not a conclusion, not a fixed end point. It is most expressively described, perhaps, as the open dimension of being. It is not knowledge of an absolute, with a capital A, but knowledge of the real nature of phenomena here and now. And it too reflects the universal principle of dependent origination. Only it does so in a crucially specific way that halts the wheel of suffering in a growing illumination of the whole process. It was a female disciple of the Buddha, Dharmadina, who first articulated this way of distinguishing samsara and nirvana. In samsara, we veer between pleasure and suffering. However, the rationale of the spiritual life is that by means of mindfulness, a still attentiveness of the mind, it is possible instead to go from a positive experience to a further positive experience. The way she puts it, in dependence upon suffering, faith arises, and then joy, rapture, bliss, happiness, concentration, and in dependence on that, there arises knowledge and vision of things as they really are, which is the beginning of awakening. The fourth noble truth, the Noble Eightfold Path. This is the fourth and final noble truth, the truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. This is the medicine, the Noble Eightfold Path. The path of right understanding, of right resolve, of right speech, of right action, of right livelihood, of right effort, of right mindfulness, and of right concentration. But how do we go about getting onto this path?
Doing no evil, undertaking to do what is good, and purifying the heart. This is the teaching of the Buddhas.
Nirvana does not take place in some special time or place. In whatever way one may busy oneself to make it happen, it can only ever take place in the heart. The Buddha taught only what is verifiable by direct experience. His Dharma cannot be understood unless it is taken up personally. It is a working out of a principle which is universal, which one cannot observe from outside. Any view we have of it, even the Buddhist view, will be a partial view. It can only be realized in oneself. Language implies a shared understanding of the way the world works, but the goal of Buddhism clearly involves a complete reversal of the way we live and understand our lives. Therefore, the Dharma is essentially incommunicable. The Buddha's solution to this problem is to present his findings not as a statement of truth, but as a path or progress of gradually refining out delusion and craving. This means that one does not have fully to appreciate the goal in order to work effectively at a lower level. One cannot, in fact. To be a Buddhist is simply to orient oneself in a certain direction, basing oneself upon whatever level of experience one has attained. The Dharma is described by the Buddha as excellent in the beginning, excellent in the middle, and excellent in the end. Thus, Buddhist faith is never blind. It is firmly rooted in an actual experience of the fact that the Dharma works right from the word go. The eight limbs of the Noble Eightfold Path. The Noble Eightfold Path consists of eight limbs in which we can apply the Dharma. They are interlocking in that none can be effectively practiced without the others. However, they may also be gathered up into just three, arranged in a progressive sequence: morality, meditation, and wisdom. Morality, or ethics. First, right speech, right action, and right livelihood belong to the sphere of ethics. We may feel we have an inkling of what the Dharma is about. The fact that it seems so difficult to grasp, however, is because we reinforce our ignorance by relating to others in our speech and actions, as if we were a separate and supreme reality. So this is the way ethics is viewed, as a moral choice that takes place at the deepest level. Unethical action arises naturally out of being deluded. Truly ethical action arises naturally out of clear vision. Thus, ethics and wisdom arise in mutual dependence on one another. The ethical life is the happy life, the beautiful life, the life lived in harmony with the way things are. So the practice of ethics is a training of the mind to be alert for opportunities to create kindness and generosity and renunciation, and to sidestep the demands of the ego. It is a sort of inner judo. Just when one imagines that one is selflessly taking care of the needs of others, one finds oneself neatly floored by a rush of resentment, followed, if one isn't careful to pick oneself up good-humouredly, by a scathing attack of self-disgust. Always examining the intention, the mental state in which one acts, rather than just following the rules, means that the practice of ethics is creative, even playful, rather than an imposed burden. So one is unable to settle into deceptively neat solutions. One cannot play the game of hypothetical ethical dilemmas. Morality is about being fully alive to the present occasion. Paradoxically, what produces this spontaneity is the sustained development of skillful habits. Just as a sweet judo throw that appears to come out of nowhere actually comes from years of training. Hence the importance of right livelihood. Making a decision about what one spends most of one's day doing is perhaps the most ethically crucial choice of one's life. So, there are no Buddhist commandments. Instead, there are training principles. These need to be interpreted skillfully according to one's level of development. Because again, they represent a progressive path of practice. One may take up any number of precepts, but there are five basic ones that all Buddhists observe at whatever level they can. One starts by making a declaration of the overall orientation of one's life, by saying, "I go for refuge to the Buddha, to the Dharma, and to the Sangha." Then one undertakes the following training principles: to abstain from harming living beings, to abstain from taking the not given, to abstain from sexual misconduct, to abstain from false speech, to abstain from getting intoxicated. These precepts are chanted throughout the Buddhist world. Meditation. The second stage of the three great stages of the path is meditation. Right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration are all concerned with the most direct way of transforming the mind and penetrating into the true nature of things. Normally, one is not aware of the fine detail of one's mental states because of the sheer volume of sensory input coming in all the time. One simply finds oneself eating, or going into a rage, or walking into the shop and buying whatever one's craving directs. One more usually becomes aware when one can't have what one wants. And this is the key to meditation. By sitting still and closing down, as far as one can, one's connection to objects of craving through the senses, one no longer indulges craving. And in this way, one can bring more awareness into it. One is then aware of mental states while one is experiencing them. And this awareness brings choice. As craving and hatred and so on are experienced as uncomfortable distractions from awareness, it becomes clear that they are essentially unconscious. It becomes equally clear that a mental state which is actually imbued with awareness is necessarily one that is positive. People who are fully absorbed in what they do are happy. Meditation simply develops this state of absorption directly. It is a sort of hothousing process to germinate mental states that rarely have a chance in the outside world. Positive emotions like loving-kindness and mindfulness are more elusive, less defining of ourselves as against others that are negative emotions. They need to be developed and maintained by constant but sensitive effort until they become second nature. Experiencing one's own mind in meditation, one experiences the fruit of one's actions more directly. To begin with, this may be discomfort and distraction, but if one accepts this experience, then a deeper and intensely pleasurable integration of the mind can start to take place. In this way, what one experiences is just oneself. One cannot blame anyone else for what one experiences. One has to take responsibility for everything. This is self-knowledge, knowing the mind. Being aware of every passing thought and of the emotional roots of every passing thought, good and bad, is enough to change their direction. To be aware is to be free. Instead of reacting to events unconsciously from a mind that is half somewhere else, one becomes fully alive to things and aware of the choices of action before one at every moment. The Dharma is to be realized in the deepest seat of consciousness, in the depths of the heart. It can only do this when we find and occupy that place. This is achieved through meditation. Wisdom. The third and final stage of the path is wisdom. This consists of right understanding, traditionally based on an ever-deepening insight into the Four Noble Truths, together with right emotion, which means bringing a response of the heart to that understanding. The Buddha said that the Dharma is as difficult to grasp rightly and as dangerous to grasp wrongly as a poisonous water snake. One has only to consider the cruelties that have been inflicted by people on the basis of their perverse understanding of ultimate truth to appreciate this. The key to right understanding, however, is the recognition that it is a path, not a sort of catechism or creed. Understanding is developed in conjunction with the practice of ethics and meditation and positive emotion, in particular faith, until there arises not a conceptual understanding, but wisdom, real vision, insight, or direct seeing, unmediated by conceptual thought. However, that direct seeing of the truth is arrived at on the basis of a clear grasp of relative truth. This is not vague truth. It is simply conceptual truth. Visionary insights do arise apparently spontaneously, of course, but they will only take us so far if we limit ourselves with wrong or vague ideas of the true nature of things. The growth of the Dharma after the Buddha. The Four Noble Truths and the Noble Eightfold Path are the foundation teachings of the Buddha. Upon this hugely solid basis, everything else that we know as Buddhism was built. Over the centuries, the millennia that were to come, all sorts of fantastic towers and audacious extensions would be erected on top of it. As we shall see in the next section on the Sangha, followers of the Buddhist path were encouraged to make the Dharma their own, even remake it to their own specifications. When individuals became enlightened, it was always an individual vision. And if they were able to express it, then the results could sometimes appear to have come a long way from the Four Noble Truths. The Buddha himself displayed untiring inventiveness in reaching out to the heart of anyone he met. And in terms of imaginative and intellectual scope, there can be very little to match the creative genius of the Buddha's Sangha in India and in China, Japan and Tibet. However, one can certainly say that all these developments may be set down as footnotes to the Four Noble Truths. One does not come to a realization of the Buddha's message from an accumulation of knowledge about the Dharma. That will simply add to one's load. All that is required is a stirring of the depths, a turning around of something, a moment of realization of the fact that one simply knows nothing about it at all, and never has done. There is then the possibility of the arising of knowledge and vision of things as they really are. As the monk Hakuin exhorted, "Followers of the Buddha's way, why look for the truth in far-off places? Both delusion and truth are in the depths of your own hearts."
Dhammo me saranam varam.